Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast, the podcast that is dedicated towards bridging the divide between the police and the communities that they serve. Thank you so much for coming along with me and with us as we look to do just that, and that is bridge that divide between the police and the communities that they serve. So we got a good episode for you today. This is going to be a bonus episode because of the COVID-19, the coronavirus that is going on. We're going to address that situation. And I really appreciate my guest for today, Dr. Rashawn Ray of the Brookings Institute. He is going to help us to understand why some members of different communities are being especially hit hard as far as their rates of death and everything like that. So I just want to read to you a little bit about my guest for today. His name is Rashawn Ray. He's a David M. Rubenstein Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institute. He's an Associate Professor of Sociology and Executive Director of the Lab for Applied Social Science Research at the University of Maryland, College Park. He is also one of the co-editors of Context Magazine, Sociology for Public. Dr. Ray's research addresses the mechanisms that manufacture and maintain racial and social inequity, with a particular focus on police-civilian relations and men's treatment of women. His work also speaks to ways that inequality may be attenuated through racial uplift activism and social policy. So what you can do is you can go over to Brookings, that's Brookings.edu. You can read over his bio there. It's quite extensive. He's been published in New York Times, Huffington Post. He's also been on NBC News, selected as a member of the 40 Under 40 Prince George County Award, and awarded the 2016 UMD Research Communicator Award. Ray has appeared in C-SPAN, MSN, HLN, Al Jazeera, NPR, and Fox News. His research has been cited by Washington Post, Associated Press, CNN, The Root, and The Chronicle. So we got a big time person for us for today. So I really appreciate Dr. Rashawn Ray taking the time and the energy to come on and talk with us and speak with us and address some very, very vital and important issues. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, let's get into the conversation as we're going to analyze one of the pieces that he wrote for Brookings, which is called Why Are Blacks Dying at Higher Rates from COVID, that's COVID-19. Once again, this can be found at brookings.edu. Just go head on over there. You can research his name, Rashawn Ray, and you can find this article that he published, Why Are Blacks Dying at Higher Rates from COVID-19. So that's what we're going to be discussing. Without further ado, here's the interview. All right, man. So thank you so much. We're talking with Dr. Rashawn Ray. And thank you so much for being on Captain Hunter's podcast. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited, you know, to have this important conversation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I was reading over a bunch of different stuff and I came across your article that you wrote. Now, you wrote it for Brookings Institute, right? That you work for Brookings Institute. And the title of the article, and it's not in front of me, which is really embarrassing, but it had to do with why are blacks dying at a larger proportional rate than, you know, the rest of the population. And I thought right. It was an important article, and I really, really appreciated your writing it. So before we get into that, why don't you just tell the audience just a little bit about yourself?
So Dr. Rashawn Ray, as you mentioned, I'm a David M. Rubenstein Fellow at the Brookings Institution. I'm also an Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Maryland at College Park, and I'm the Executive Director of the Lab for Applied Social Science Research, which I'm imagining one of the things we'll be talking about is policing and criminal justice. So we have a large virtual reality platform where we perform virtual reality simulations and trainings for police departments around the country and Department of Homeland Security. And then I also co-edit Context Magazine, Sociology for the Public. It's context with an S.org. What we do is we publish sociological research. It's for the public and policymakers.
Okay. Okay. So just explain to a little bit more about the virtual reality that you do for police officers. Since that's my former right. line of work there.
Right. So we developed a virtual reality training program with some large companies. And essentially what we do is it's an upgrade to existing tactical training platforms. Essentially what happens is police officers come in or we go to their departments, set up our virtual reality simulations, officers put on virtual reality goggles. They are immersed in a full 360 degree virtual environment, and they encounter scenarios that they would in everyday life, traffic stops, suspicious person scenes at bus stops, convenience store robberies, domestic incidents at the house. And then we vary the setting. So we vary the person, we vary their behavior, and we have full artificial intelligence. So when they're interacting with the characters are directly responding to them. We have probably about like 3,000 responses that the virtual reality characters provide. So in real time, officers are able to do training. They're able to get responses from the training staff. And then the other part is we're able to layer that up with a series of physiological outcomes, such as we can do eye tracking, we can do body movement, we can do how quickly officers touch their weapon. We can also measure stress through speech and also heart rate. So, I mean, it's really innovative. It's a cutting edge. Nobody around the country or really in the world is really doing it in the way we're doing it. And I mean, we've worked with dozens of small, medium and large size departments. And, you know, it's interesting because when people in law enforcement or someone who does this kind of work, when they hear about it, they're like, I haven't heard about it before. And I'm like, that's the point. You know, part of our point is to allow a lot of anonymity and confidentiality with the police departments and the police officers we work with. So, you know, rarely will people ever hear me say who those departments were. We are kind of coming to the end of kind of one wave of confidentiality where we will be publishing some research. But again, still no names, you know, definitely nothing like badge number, isn't anything like that. And we don't even mention departments. We just kind of give regions. So, you know, I'll say, yeah, we work with departments on the East Coast, the South, the Midwest, those sort of things. But part of it is to provide training with the ultimate goal, of course, to improve police civilian relations, improve police officer decision making, and really in a lot of ways to reduce the implicit bias that we know exists when police officers interact with civilians.
Do you think that that type of training is effective? I mean, I've gone back and forth with people who think it is effective, think it's not effective. What are your opinions about that?
Yeah. So one of the things that is different about what we do, we're social scientists, right? So we actually measure the effectiveness of things. Never will we release anything unless we can prove that it's actually effective. And that's one of the things that we've been doing. So the simple answer is yes. Yes, it's highly effective. I think it, you know, there are a lot of things that go into it, but part of it, we experimentally test whether or not it's effective. So some of the findings that we have thus far are a few. One of the first big things is, of course, people always want to know, does bias exist in policing? You know, officers, whomever, people like, oh, they're saying officers are biased, but if I was in this situation, I would have done something similar. Da, da, da. Well, you know, actually, yeah, people probably would have made that same decision. And sometimes those decisions are biased. Sometimes they're not. And what we've been able to actually do is to integrate people's attitudes with their behaviors, which rarely is done. Oftentimes, people, in this case, police officers, sit down at a computer. They do some kind of test and it's attitudinal. And then they go out into the field and it's difficult to attach those things. Well, we have implicit attitudes, meaning unconscious attitudes, unconscious biases that people oftentimes don't know they have or they're unwilling to admit. And then we have explicit attitudes, meaning attitudes that people are willing to admit to, that they acknowledge, that they actually think. And then we have their actual behavior, how they interact with people. And then we further layer that up with people's physiological outcomes, which I just kind of went through, stress level, heart rate, reaction time, all those sort of things, eye movement. And what we found is that across the board, there is bias that exists among police officers, just like the general population. That shouldn't be surprising to anyone. People in law enforcement are people like everybody else. And I think oftentimes that doesn't necessarily come through. People act like they're robots, that they should just work 24/7, that they shouldn't get rest, that they shouldn't get paid adequately. All these other factors that we kind of layer up in my center to help us make sense of what's going on. The other big thing we find is that the race of the officer doesn't matter. So the perception that the white male officer is just out going out discriminating against people, we don't find that. I mean, we find across the board that whether or not the person is white or black or whether or not the person is a man or a woman, we see similar outcomes. Now, I've also done a lot of research within police departments. And so this is where it gets confusing to people. Even though we don't see racial differences among officers and how they interact with people on the street, that doesn't mean there aren't racial differences internally in terms of the way that black officers, minority officers, and women officers are treated. And of course, there's a lot of evidence there. So yeah, we definitely find that they're effective. Now, this is the key with effectiveness, though. Oftentimes with implicit bias trainings, and we have a large one that, you know, again, we've used with departments, we've done with Department of Homeland Security and the like. Part of what we do that's different oftentimes there are these blanket implicit bias trainings. I did these for years. I've done them for like, well, 5 years with police departments, but about 10 to 12 years with organizations and the military and the like. We come in, we do this large training. We focus on everything under the sun, race and gender and, you know, sexual orientation and the like. The problem is that I've learned is that departments are different. So we might interact with a department in the South and they might have an issue with class. We might interact with a department in the Mid-Atlantic and they might have an issue with gender. We might interact with a department in the Midwest and then they have an issue with race. So if you're having this blanket implicit bias training, you're not actually targeting the problem. So what we do is officers go through our virtual reality program. We then examine whether or not biases exist. We provide departments information and say, hey, on these 10 metrics, 7 of them, there was no bias. But on these 3, there is bias. And here are what the factors were that determined this bias. So what we recommend is an implicit bias training that can specifically focus on these issues. Then we bring officers back in again and have them go back through the virtual reality program with the understanding that the specific training they went through will help to deal with that issue that department is dealing with. And that's what makes what we're doing different.
Very nice. I'm definitely going to have you back on to go over an implicit bias training and really kind of break it down in more detail. That sounds fascinating what you're doing. And I was an implicit bias instructor with my department when I was there. So I definitely understand a lot about what you're saying. So I just had someone else on, another scholar before, and he thought that the whole idea of implicit bias training was completely a joke. Alex Vitale. So he wanted to kind of focus on something else. So everybody has their opinions. I think we need to do everything in order to help to make the relationship between the police and the communities better.
Let me weigh one quick point about that. You know, like, I think that's a key difference between what we do and what other people do. So people have a lot of opinions. And what I just said is an opinion. Like, it's just fact. Like, if you set things up this way, they actually do work. A lot of people say, oh, it didn't work for me. It didn't work. Well, what I always say, I'm like, was it actually assessed? Or was it just the fact people went through a class and then you just expect to see changes? That's not actually doing research to examine whether or not it's been effective or not. So to your point, I love how you phrased it, because like a lot of people have opinions. And then I'm like, so have you like done the studies? Have you actually examined the studies? They're like, no. I'm like, well, see, it's just your opinion. That's the difference between what I say and what other people say. Like, I'm not saying opinion. I'm saying what it actually is. And I think maybe what one of your previous guests were actually talking about is there are a lot of limitations to implicit bias if there aren't real organizational changes in the department. And you know this as well. So you can have officers go through an implicit bias training. You can have officers go through a training and it's very clear that you're just supposed to just kind of go through the motions, just kind of get through it, that it's not really something that you should apply in everyday life when you're out in the field. Of course, it's not going to be effective. The other thing that we know is if there aren't real consequences internally when bias does exist, then of course it's not going to be changes. And that's internal and external, because one of the things that we've done working with a lot of departments, we find that a lot of the bias that actually exists is internal between officers themselves. One officer says something to another officer, is racially charged, they file a complaint, and then the officer who files the complaint is the one that then the officer who files the complaint is the one who ends up being reassigned, and the officer who actually committed the allegation is just sent along their way like normal. So it's a lot of things, but overall, it's kind of a lack of accountability on policing. But we'll talk about that later, because I can talk about that all day. But you right. Jumped me off, so I had to talk about it.
Yeah, I have a tendency to do that. So, like I said, I want to have you on to talk about this disparity that's going on as far as more African-Americans dying than in relation to their counterparts. And I don't even like that word counterparts. It sounds like we're always pitted against each other. I really have a problem with that term, but that's what some people are saying. So explain to us why you wrote this article, and is this something that we should be concerned about, where more African-Americans are dying from? Not only, or are they contracting and dying, or just contracting and dying, or just dying from, or what are the numbers here?
All of the above.
Okay.
So when it comes to race and COVID-19, although COVID-19 is an equal opportunity virus, our society is not an equal opportunity society. And even though we see that everyone from the upper echelons of society, from, you know, Tom Hanks or Prince Charles of Wales or Boris Johnson who's the prime minister of Great Britain, or, you know, the president of Harvard. I mean, the list could go on and on. Chris Cuomo. The point is that the same way it hits those individuals like Kevin Durant and Idris Elba, it's also hitting people in the lower echelons of society. And part of what happens is when people are lower income and people are in urban areas, they're less likely to have access to health care. They are less likely to have the ability to actually get to a place to seek treatment. They're also more likely to live in neighborhoods that are less healthy and less safe. So let's just kind of walk through this. One thing we know from statistics and the work that I've done analysis on states in the Midwest, states in the South. So Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, Louisiana, Maryland, Kansas, the list could go on and on. Overwhelmingly, what it shows is that Blacks are more likely to contract COVID-19 and die from COVID-19. The states I've analyzed, Blacks are about 70% more likely than their percentage of the state to die from COVID-19. In St. Louis, nearly all of the deaths from COVID-19 have been Black Americans. In Michigan, Blacks represent about 70% of all the deaths. In Louisiana, Blacks represent about 70% of all the deaths. In Chicago, in Milwaukee County, Blacks represent about 70% of all the deaths. So we see the ways that Blacks are overrepresented. One of the things people have been trying to say is that it's something about Black people's blood or Black people's behavior, and neither of which are true. Underneath the skin, we're basically all the same. However, the way that our environment influences our bodies are the things that are different. The other thing people try to say is that people's behavior, Black people's behavior, is what's actually determining this. But unfortunately, the way we might describe people being at a cookout in a predominantly Black neighborhood is drastically different the way that we're describing people who are walking along a beach in Florida that's reopened. And of course, oftentimes there's a racial gap there in terms of the people that are represented. The big thing is this: structural conditions undergird pre-existing health conditions. Black people are more likely to suffer from heart disease, diabetes, and diabetes. Part of what that means, though, it's not something that's innate to Black people. Oftentimes, the environments we come from, the neighborhoods we come from, actually lead to these pre-existing health conditions happening. As I mentioned, less access to healthy food options. One big thing I've been saying is, if you got $10 in your pocket and you're trying to feed a family of four, like I have a family of four, you're trying to feed a family of four with $10, are you going to go to the Whole Foods that doesn't exist in your neighborhood? Or are you going to go to the, see, you're already laughing because you already know, right? Are you going to go to the Whole Foods that doesn't exist in your neighborhood? Or are you going to go to the McDonald's on the corner? Pretty much everyone is going to make the same decision. And when we look in predominantly Black neighborhoods, and oftentimes at times predominantly Latino neighborhoods and low-income neighborhoods, is that they are devoid of healthy food options. No grocery stores, or the grocery stores that do exist, they don't have healthy foods. They don't have fresh fruits and vegetables. They are overpopulated with fast food restaurants. A lack of places to engage in physical activity. No parks. Very little lighting. Very few gyms. Then, of course, we layer that up with another structural element, which is the fact that Black Americans are more likely to work these quote unquote new essential jobs. Right. These jobs that we now consider essential because we need to go to the grocery store or do Instacart and get brownies and make them at home with our kids while we're able to telework and have our kids engage in homeschooling. So part of what this means is about 20-25% of these new essential workers are Black Americans, including cashiers, people who work in restaurants, people who bag groceries, people who work in transit, people who drive buses, people who drive trains. You know this. As a law enforcement officer, that these are the types of jobs where we see Black Americans overrepresented. So what this means is now we are more likely to be exposed to people, and we're more likely then to be exposed to the disease, and we're more likely to bring that back to our neighborhoods. Final point I'll make deals with healthcare. Lack of healthcare access. There are fewer hospitals, fewer healthcare facilities, fewer urgent care clinics, fewer specialty care areas, fewer pharmacies. So even if a person does go to actually seek treatment and they get tested and are positive, they're given a prescription, they might go back to their neighborhood and either a pharmacy doesn't exist or the pharmacy that does exist, it takes 2, 3, or 4 days for the medication to come in. These are days that they actually don't have. All these factors I just laid out are structural factors that actually lead to Black people being more exposed to the virus, more likely to contract it, and more likely to die from COVID-19.
Very nice. So what can we do in order to attack this? I've kind of given up on the government trying to do things. I think we really need to really kind of take the bull by the horns ourselves and really stop looking for other people to do things, because we, what can we do in order to fix some of these problems?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So let me give a quick analogy, then I'll give some solutions, right? So the second piece I wrote was about what we can do to close the racial gap. And people can just go to brookings.edu, search my name, Rayshon Ray, they'll pop up. And what's interesting is what I laid out were short and long-term goals. So in the short term, from a policy standpoint, I do think, because Brookings is a policy think tank. So I do think there are some things we do. First thing, we need to get demographic data. So one of the reasons I think why people are so surprised about this is because when COVID-19 hit, all we kept hearing about were older people and wealthy people. Well, a person like me studying this, I knew it was just a matter of time before it hit impoverished communities, before it hit the Black and Latino community. And now I'm really worried about COVID-19 hitting rural communities, especially with states like Georgia opening up. I mean, I grew up in Atlanta. I'm from Tennessee. I went to college at University of Memphis. I did a postdoc at University of California, Berkeley, with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. So I've lived in all regions of the country, and I can tell you there are rural areas no matter where they're located. But the Deep South is particularly deprived. So I'm extremely worried that COVID-19, that we're about to see a re-rise in cases in the South and a re-rise in deaths. And I think that's going to primarily be concentrated among Black people, but also rural white people. Because the thing about rural America is that whether or not you're in Black rural America or white rural America, they oftentimes don't have hospital beds. And there's a key reason why. The reason why they don't have hospital beds is because a lot of the states in the South and a lot of the counties actually turned down Affordable Care Act money related to Medicare and Medicaid because they didn't want to support a President Obama's policy, which is unfortunate because the people living there really need that, regardless of their race, regardless of their background, regardless of their political ideology. People deserve the right to have access to care and have equality. You know, it doesn't necessarily matter whether or not people think the same. We should actually be putting people over profits. And we're not necessarily seeing that, particularly when it comes to politics. When it comes to policies, collection of demographic data. We know race and place are highly linked to one another. In other words, you give me a zip code, I can tell you a lot about what race the person probably is and also their income. That's because our neighborhoods are highly segregated. We also need information on gender and age, and we need to collectively look at them as well as looking at pre-existing health conditions. This tells us not only where we should direct resources, but also where we should be learning from. States like Minnesota and Oklahoma and even Ohio to a certain extent don't really have racial gaps. Why is that? There are Black cities in those states. Why do they not have a gap? What are they doing that's different than what, say, other states have been doing? What has California and Maryland been doing to actually deal with the racial gap? I think there's a lot that can be learned by collecting data and examining those data. So this doesn't become people's opinion. This is actually simply what it is. Second, you talked about what can people do? Well, I think what we need to do, we need to urge our policymakers to allocate funding to provide testing sites in Black communities. And I think Black churches can be that. As you know, no matter which neighborhood you go to, you're going to be able to find a Black church. And the research I've done with Dr. Abigail Sewell, we found two things. First, when Black men know about the Tuskegee syphilis study, they are less likely to utilize healthcare. That makes sense. I've been telling people all the time, you go to a restaurant and say I tell you to go to a restaurant, Captain. I'm like, hey, go to this restaurant. Food's good. He's like, all right, Ray said go to this. I'm going to check it out, right? You go, and the service is horrible, and the food isn't good. You're going to say, well, he told me to go. Maybe they were having a bad day. Let me go back. So you go back again, and the service is bad again, and the food isn't good. You know what? You're not going to go again. That's what happens when Black people utilize healthcare. So we are less likely to trust healthcare because when we interact with physicians, we're more likely to be spoken to instead of spoken with. Those are drastically different conversations when somebody is talking at you compared to talking with you. This leads to people just being less likely to utilize healthcare. But when people attend Black Protestant churches, they are more likely to utilize healthcare because they trust the recommendations where they're coming from. They've been able to find healthcare providers who treat people equitably. So we can run through churches what's called health equity zones, very similar to President Obama's promise zones, which are hubs for resources in underserved neighborhoods, dealing with education, dealing with other things. So as we see churches handing out, you know, sack lunches to kids and handing out laptops and bringing in the homeless, we can do testing and triage there. And then two final things we need. Hazard pay for essential workers. Look, these people bagging our groceries are putting their lives on the line. According to the Department of Labor and Department of Commerce, they say people should get hazard pay if they are exposed to something at work that might kill them. Well, COVID-19 is that. Finally, we need to actually raise the minimum wage, give people a guaranteed income. In the state of Tennessee, minimum wage is $7.25. If you work 40 hours a week, That's less than $1,200 a month. The average apartment in the city of Nashville is $1,400. You already have a deficit even before you've even tried to pay one bill besides your rent. So I think those are things that can be done. I also think that it can be a lot of awareness spread that because of miscommunication, because of a lack of medical mistrust, people don't know who to trust and people don't know who to believe. And we kind of need to set the record straight that anybody can get COVID-19, that masks do work, which of course is a problem for Black men. As you know, in law enforcement, it's a lot of people worried about having to wear a mask in public. But we put all these factors together and it leads to Black people being more exposed. But these are some of the things that we can do to deal with it.
So the mask issue, I know, I believe you wrote about that before. We haven't seen anything recently. I think some of the stuff was beginning of April, the end of March or so. Hopefully that whole nonsense is being corrected within the minds of law enforcement, where they stop stopping Black males from doing all this. So in the short term, and another thing that you mentioned is that a lot of Black men are dying from it. And that's because, once again, we're on the front lines. And this idea of these preconditions, right? This COVID-19 exacerbating these preconditions. Talk a little bit about that, a little bit more about that, if you would.
Yeah. So part of what happens when you have a virus like COVID-19 is that it sends your body into a shock. There are a series of symptoms. Excruciating headaches, body aches, extremely high temperatures, shortness of breath, and these temperature fluctuations, oftentimes where people's temperatures are going to 103, 104. My wife is a healthcare provider and she gets really, really freaked out when people's fevers spike to 104 because that's stroke level. And I think a lot of people don't realize that. So what that means is that's stroke level for a person who has a good kind of health regime. People whose bodies are under more pressure, either their hearts, their lungs, the fact that they have lower high blood sugar, leads to their bodies not being able to respond as well to something like COVID-19, which then leads to them being more likely to die. And of course, that's coupled as well with the fact that oftentimes, and there's been a lot of anecdotal research on this, that when Black people have been calling hotlines and going to emergency rooms to seek care, they've been more likely to be sent home. Sometimes sent home saying, you know, you'll get better, just take some medication. But other times just simply sent home. And you put those factors together and it leads to Black people, say like the 27-year-old woman in Atlanta, Maryland, who died. Or, you know, the young brother was 25 years old, was an engineer who died up in Michigan. I mean, these are the kind of things that shouldn't necessarily be happening. So even though it's more likely to hit middle-aged Black men and older Black men, it's also hitting people across the board. And so it's definitely symptoms that people need to pay attention to. There are hotlines in every state that people should call. People should say, if they have a fever, I have a fever. I haven't necessarily been able to take deep breaths. These sort of things will actually lead to people being more likely to get treatment and getting the help that they actually need.
Very good. Very good. We touched on the equality. Actually, you went into a great deal about the inequality. What do we see going forward with any type of nationalized health care, really addressing the inequality, financial inequality between the races, communities, between, as you mentioned, whatever zip code that you live in? All of this plays into this. Do we see a real national conversation about the wealth gap, the inequality gap? Do we see a national conversation going forward about this?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think that there is a national conversation. I think one thing that people don't realize, and, you know, working at Brookings and having the opportunity to testify on Capitol Hill on bills and legislation, and I'm up there often, is that there is a huge disconnect, a huge political divide in terms of just being open to certain ideas like universal health care. And it's unfortunate. And it's unfortunate because the facts don't back the system that we currently have. So the United States, when it comes to healthcare costs per capita, meaning how much we spend on each person, has increased about 100% over the past decade or two. We are spending so much money on healthcare. In fact, the United States spends 25% more per capita than any other country in the world. Switzerland is second, which of course has one of the best healthcare systems. So them spending that money is slightly justified. But this is the thing. In the United States, some people have excellent health care and some people don't. So what that means is the people who don't have health care, who don't have access to good health care, when they do get sick, The only time they go is when they feel like they're about to die. What that means is they then oftentimes go to an emergency room or the ambulance has to come get them. Anyone who's ever been to an emergency room and looked at their bill, even if their insurance was covering it, knows that those prices are astronomical. So by actually implementing universal health care, we will allow people to get out in front of their pre-existing health conditions, maintain them, hopefully reverse them, lead to less flooding of people into emergency rooms, lead to less back-end cost for either late life care or for people going to the emergency room. And there was a recent report that came out on 195 countries around the world, a pandemic response report, in fact. And what it found was that the United States ranked number one. Now, the United States had an 84%. You know, as a university professor, I mean, that's just a me to be. It's nothing to write home about. But, you know, I mean, it's just 84%. But the key point is this. Number one at 84%. You know, that would like never happen in one of my classes unless it was, you know, either some professor just being asinine or maybe a course that I took when I was getting my PhD. But overall, 84% is nothing to write home about. The key point, though, is why did the United States get that 84%? The United States was number one in financing, but only scored 66% in healthcare access and actually scored lower than some African countries, including Congo and Liberia, that has been aiming to do a really good job of responding to Ebola, actually scored lower than those countries in responding timely to pandemics. That's why we are where we are. Unfortunately, COVID-19 is an equal opportunity disease. Our healthcare system is not an equitable system. So what we have to do is take a health equity approach to actually putting the most vulnerable people in a position where they get the care they need, and then everyone else is going to get the care they need. But instead, up to this point, we've been taking a colorblind approach to a societal problem that is not colorblind.
Very good. Very good. I thank you for coming on. I know you're pressed for time, but I'm definitely going to be reaching back out to you. I really want to talk about this implicit bias thing. So just give us a brief summary. What can we do going forward? It's almost May. Mother's Day is going to be coming up. You know, people want to go out. They want to get back to work. As you mentioned, what's going on down in Georgia? They want to open up the economy down there. Mayor in Las Vegas made some asinine statements about opening up the casinos. So what do we do to stay safe? What do we do?
Yeah, I mean, some of these comments have been crazy. She said we're going to serve as a control group, which wasn't even right. I mean, anyway, so let's get on track. So your question was, what can we do? So I think the first thing we could do is, aim to keep ourselves and our families safe, including our households. You know, one of the things I've learned from my wife, who again has her own health clinic, is there is a process that healthcare providers go through when they come in the house to not expose their house and their family. And I think people should do those things. Take your shoes off, either in the garage or wipe them off really good. Also, when you go get groceries, wear gloves, wear masks. Now, a mask is required in the state of Maryland, but not in other places, right? So you have to figure out what's required and what's not. But you should still try to do that in public. And I get, again, as I've talked a lot about, look, Black men, I mean, of course, it's something that we worry about. And so, you know, those are things that, of course, is going to be an added struggle for us. But we still want to try to protect our family. Wear gloves. When you bring your groceries in the house, wipe them down with wipes, spray them off with disinfectant. Do not put that stuff in your body, like Trump is trying to say. But overall, I think that's what we need to do to keep our household safe.
We can just inject sunlight into us.
Don't do that. Right? But the big thing I'll say is check in on the people you care about. I think if everybody checks in on the people they care about, and I think that's the thing, you know, it's been a lot of negativity around COVID-19, and even the research I do, I aim to highlight problems and then say what we should do about it. But it's a lot of people being superheroes, tons of frontline workers, from healthcare providers, police officers, firefighters, people who are serving us food, people who are bagging our groceries, literally putting their lives on the line. Give them a thank you. You know, give them a smile. Their lives are way more difficult than ours are. I think the other thing we can do is check in on people whose industries we know have faltered a lot. These might be one specifically that most people use are barbers and hairstylists. you know, check in on them, maybe send them a little bit of money. Maybe say, you know, if you just don't want to give a gift, say, hey, here's the money for the next time I go get my cut. Right. Just keep a record of this. I just wanted to go ahead and prepay. That's going to help them to be able to put food on the table. So I think it's a lot of things that we can do as individuals. Maybe there's a family, you know, who have, you know, 2, 3, 4 kids and they only got one laptop and maybe you have an extra one. And even though it might be old, give it to them. Maybe they can at least pull it up and do some of their work. So I think it's a lot of things that we can do to help ourselves get through this pandemic.
Absolutely. That's good advice there. My brother, you know, he was missing out on his haircut. So he called up his barber and the barber actually came to his house. So that may be something that people can do. You know, I didn't ask, but hopefully the barber had mask on and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
cut outside of the backyard, you know. So
I worry about the Clippers, right? Yeah. I'm sanitizing Clippers in person, but you know, I mean, that's a good example. Like just figuring out how to get people back to work, giving a little money, right. And you know, I mean, I think about it like this: if say for my barber, 10 people give $25, that's $250 that she might be able to buy some groceries for her own family. Right. You know, my tithe and mobile for a couple of weeks, you know, and I think those are the kind of things we need, but particularly because we know that barbers and hairstylists, because oftentimes they're independent contractors, are left out of small business money. That's something we need to talk about. And minority areas are being left out of these small business loan and grant programs that's coming from the federal government. So
are they not? I thought they were included in that. I thought some small businesses.
No. So small businesses are. So the barbershop might be, but it depends on whether or not the barbershop has employees or independent contractors. And, you know, as you know, that's the difference between, okay, I'm going to allow you to pay me booth rent, which is kind of like an independent contractor, right, compared to me getting a percentage of all of your cuts. Those are different things, which right, then qualify a person as an employee or independent contractor. You know, most barbers and hairstylists want to be independent contractors, right, which means they fill out 1099s. So even though the barbershop could qualify depending on how many employees they have. But that's been something that has been a big issue with the small business money, that a lot of minority small businesses, particularly hairstylists, barbershops, cakeries, small restaurants, have been left out of this money.
Very good. Thank you so much. I'm definitely going to have you back. Thank you so much, Dr. Rayshawn Ray, for coming to Captain Hunter's podcast. I really, really appreciate it. Good information you gave out today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Once again, I want to thank my special guest, Dr. Rayshawn Ray, for coming on Captain Hunter's podcast. Really great and important conversation that we are having concerning this matter of COVID-19 and the alarming rates in proportions of the Black population who are dying because of this terrible disease. So I hope that people out there will listen and heed the advice of Dr. Ray. Let's all stay in our homes and let's just do what we got to do in order to protect ourselves. As I mentioned before, I don't think that the government is really doing everything in their power in order to make sure that the public and the population are protected. Many states are willing to open up. The mayor in Las Vegas was willing to let her population be a guinea pigs, if you will. So it's really been a crazy, crazy time. If anything, I really think that a rock has been turned over on this country concerning COVID-19. Virus, and it really shows a lot of inequalities. In particular, what it shows is the inequality in the healthcare system, in the response, who has access to healthcare, who has access to food and groceries, and all that kind of stuff. So I really hope that after this whole situation, that we really take a good hard look at what we want to be as a country and where we want to go and how we want to handle those who are less fortunate than us. So once again, I want to thank my special guest, Dr. Rayshawn Ray, for coming on the podcast. Really great conversation. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, please support the podcast. PayPal, Cash App, Venmo. Please share this podcast through email, through Snapchat, through Twitter, through Facebook. Follow me on all those platforms, CPT L Hunter on Twitter, Instagram. This episode actually will be on YouTube as well, so you can watch us actually do the episode. As we recorded the episode, I'm going to try to start putting more episodes up on YouTube. That's Captain Hunter's podcast on YouTube. So until next time, ladies and gentlemen, much love and peace.